As most of you know, we just this past weekend had a retreat to launch our 8-week practice period. We think it's the 19th time we've done this. For those who are brand new, or almost, a practice period is a span of time each year where we kind of just intensify and strengthen our practice. And because we're not all in a monastery living in an enclosed space, people have jobs and families and responsibilities. Each person can kind of customize the practice period and make their own personal commitments to what they want to do. There's different components that they can use for the practice period. And each year we have a theme, and the theme this year is living in samsara. Samsara is this world where there's a lot of suffering. Living in samsara, suffering and resilience. So we want to look into the nature of suffering and also into the nature of resilience. And it turns out much of what our practice supports us in are the very characteristics of resilience. So for those who are new, and I know there's some people who are quite new, or new-ish, when we talk about suffering in Buddhist thought, it's something that characterizes human life, right? There is suffering in our lives. As long as we live on this earth in bodies, we are subject to suffering. That was the first noble truth that Buddha taught. And the second noble truth is that there's a cause of suffering. And the third is that the second noble truth is that the cause is trying to get or hold on to what we want, or trying to avoid or get rid of what we don't want. In other words, it's very self-focused, self-referenced. So it could be that we have something really good, like a relationship, or a bicycle that we love. And we really want to keep that really nice. We don't want anything to happen bad, right? Or something really terrible happens, or some minor annoyance. So the thing to not realize about suffering, the word is the very old word from the Buddha's time is dukkha, is it's not just suffering as we conventionally think of it, it's all kinds of dissatisfaction. From the very worst things that can possibly happen to us to the little minor, most minor annoyances and irritations that happen every day. They're all in the rain, they're all dukkha. And of course, the Buddha taught that we can be free of suffering. And when he said that we can be free of suffering, and that there's a way to do that, which is the practice of the Eightfold Path, and I'm not going to review that. We talked about that over the weekend. But it doesn't mean that none of those things happen to us. We will still get sick. We will get old. We will die. Our cell phones will break. Somebody will take the parking place that we are just about to grab. It's not that those things won't happen, but our way of responding to them is what changes with our practice, and that practice is all about developing resilience, the capacity, and this is, we made this sort of working definition over the weekend, the capacity to maintain one's sort of core values and integrity in the face of change, whether drastic change or even minor changes. So today I want to talk about one of the first questions that arises when something we don't want happens, when suffering arises? And that question, any guesses?
Why?
Why? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Why is this happening to me? Or why is this happening to someone I love? Right? That scary diagnosis. Or why did he say that to me? How could he say that to me? Right? Yeah. How could she do that? Why did she do that? Have you ever asked that question? And the one that I heard over and over again when I was working in hospice, and someone would say, why did this happen to my husband, wife, son, daughter? He was a good person. She was a good person. Why did this happen to them? Michael and I have two cats. They don't ask why. When the older cat gets carried away with the chase, jumps the younger one and chomps on his neck, the younger one screams bloody murder. I come running to break it up. By the time I get there, they're just sitting there looking like, who, me? I feel like a mother saying, all right, who started it? But they're not telling. And pretty soon, they're curled up on the sofa, grooming each other, looking so, so sweet. The younger one is not ruminating on, why did he do that to me? I didn't deserve that. He did that last week, and she yelled at me. It's not fair. And the older one has not a shred of remorse or guilt. They have already restored peace and equilibrium through cuddling and grooming. Our friend, who was grieving her recent divorce, witnessed this and said, I wish humans could be like that. It's not so simple for us, is it? We humans have come by our self-consciousness, our capacity for memory and foresight and reason, gradually over millions of years. We can see the beginnings of many of our capacities in the more intelligent primates, particularly the great apes, the gorillas, the chimpanzees, the orangutans. This past year, I read what I would call extended Dharma. I read a lot of, I read fairly omnivorously. And I read a book called Peacemaking Among the Primates by a primatologist named Frans Vanderwal. And he describes the various strategies for dealing with conflict and reconciliation among chimpanzees, and bonobos. Do you know what bonobos are? They used to be called pygmy chimpanzees, but now they have their own name. And they're really peaceful. And rhesus macaques, which are pretty smart monkeys that live in Asia, in Japan. He observes amazing. Oh, I meant to bring the book. I meant if you could just see the expressions on the faces of these apes and monkeys as they go into conflict and then resolution. It's quite amazing, a photo, to just even see the photographs. But he observes their strategies. And he observes amazing behaviors of empathy and comfort. You know, if one is suffering, the other will go and hug and groom them. And reconciliation between friends and family members through an amazingly sophisticated array of vocalizations, gestures, and actions. All that without spoken language. maybe they're better off without it. We just, sometimes when we try to reconcile with language, we just make it worse, right? They have conflicts, minor spats, and major fights arising out of greed, competition for food, or status. You know, they're a lot like, we're a lot like them, they're a lot like us. Or the attentions of a desired companion or mate. This is what they have a fight over. But overall, they are prompt and efficient about mending their relationships. In case of chimpanzees, sometimes the fights will result in death, but it's not so much deliberate killing as the result of serious wounds. And it's not common. On the whole, these apes do a way better job than we do of avoiding wholesale slaughter of their own kind. So somewhere along the way to becoming Homo sapiens, walking upright, balancing our big heavy-brained heads, we developed self-consciousness, along with awareness of self and other. You know, that this is me and that's you, and this is mine and that's yours. And also a personal death. Many of the more intelligent animal species have an awareness of death and grieve the loss of their family members or companions, but they don't worry about, I'm pretty sure, they don't worry about their own death or even have that concept. We humans come to this shocking realization, usually somewhere in our childhood when we have a first encounter with death. But even then, often we manage to keep it at arm's length well into adulthood, till it really strikes close to home. So we might be inclined to think, like the great American poet Walt Whitman, who said, "I think I could turn and live with animals. They are so placid and self-contained. I stand and look at them long and long. They do not sweat and whine about their condition. They do not lie awake in the dark and weep for their sins. They do not make me sick discussing their duty to God. Not one is dissatisfied. Not one is demented with the mania of owning things. Not one kneels to another, nor to his..." Well, that's not true. "Nor to his kind that lived thousands of years ago. Not one is respectable or unhappy over the whole earth." But we are humans, right? And with human consciousness comes the awareness of our own suffering. And the question, why? Why did that hurricane strike our village? Why did that disease strike my child? Why did my husband go crazy and violent? Why did our crops fail again this year? So, at some point, long, long ago, we needed to create some gods to answer these questions. And the gods seemed capricious and often angry. So they needed to be propitiated. So we made sacrifices to them of food and animals, even our own children. We made songs and dances and prayers to them. And we made stories to explain their behavior and give them characteristics rather like our own, but on godlike scale. Storms were the result of their anger, their fights between themselves. Famine and pestilence were punishment for our neglect of giving them offerings. There was so much that was utterly beyond our control or understanding. Now we almost think everything is under our control and understanding. But as human societies became more complex, we had to develop codes of morality and consequences for breaking them, systems of law and justice. And over the millennia, we developed new stories. The idea of one all-powerful God emerged, a God with the power to mete out punishments and rewards according to our sins or our virtue, even to whole peoples. eternal damnation in hell or eternal bliss in heaven. This strong dichotomy didn't really emerge until the early first few centuries of Christianity, along with the doctrine of original sin. And of course, that all goes back to Adam and Eve. The story goes that the devil seduced Eve into convincing Adam to pick the fruit of knowledge from the tree in the Garden of Eden. And by that act, we were all tainted with sin, which could only be redeemed by faith in Jesus Christ, and who had suffered, died, and been resurrected for our salvation. Some people have speculated that that knowledge that Adam plucked from the tree was the knowledge of self as separate from other, the knowledge of death. That would give it a rather Buddhist reading to the story, I think. Another story to answer the question why developed in South Asia around the law of karma, cause and effect. Harmful actions lead to harmful results, beneficial actions lead to beneficial results. And then karma kind of linked into the doctrine of reincarnation, such that someone whose actions are in the balance good would obtain a favorable rebirth, and someone whose actions have been harmful will be reborn in a less favorable state. This belief arose before Buddhism in the early Vedic tradition of India, which formed the basis for the Hindu tradition, which posited the existence of the Atman, or enduring soul. But the Buddha taught that there is not an enduring self or soul. He did make use of the concept of reincarnation to teach about karma, but he discouraged his followers from indulging in metaphysical speculation. He emphasized that his teachings are a way of addressing suffering right here and now. He was a pragmatist. In Buddhism, karma is associated with volition. So suffering resulting from events that in the West have been called acts of God, you know, like a tornado, would not be considered karmic. Although there is a karma in the sense of the physical laws of the universe is another kind. But how we conduct ourselves in response to cataclysmic events would be karmic, right? That distinction has not prevented simplistic interpretations of karma being used to rationalize human cruelty and injustice. Here's one small example. One of the books on our reading list that Michael and I found, it's called The Book of Calamities, Five Questions About Suffering and Its Meaning by author Peter Trachtenberg. And in his chapter on why, he travels to Sri Lanka just a few months after the terrible tsunami of 2004. That killed over 3,000 people. And he was accompanying a group of volunteers who were taking a census of orphaned children, most of whom were living with extended family members in small villages. And one child in particular made a strong impression on him. Her name was Achini, and she was 16 years old, but he says she seemed much younger, you know, than our 16-year-olds. She was very thin and very, very shy, and all the time she was staying with an aunt. She would be constantly clinging to her cousin, who was her age. The Trachtenberg's job was to take notes, and the project director said, "Here, write this down." He said, this girl's father left when she was little, and now her mother is dead. Many people are teasing her because she's an unlucky girl. And Trachtenberg was kind of taken aback. He said, this sad, anxious girl. Being the object of scorn. But in this village society, karma was equated with bad luck. And as we all know, in many cultures, including our own, the sense of shunning the unlucky, shunning the poor or the old, disabled or bereaved, is a common human behavior. We feel somehow as though misfortune and misery are contagious. So knowing why, having an explanation, gives us a sense of control, doesn't it? In a world where so much seems out of control. Again, when I was working for hospice and people would, ask why it seemed, even though there's nothing they could do to change what happened to their loved one, having died, even having some sense of why and someone to blame gave a retroactive sense of control. Because that's the other thing about knowing why, is it gives us someone to blame. The doctor who missed the diagnosis, yourself for ignoring the symptoms too long, or your loved one for ignoring the symptoms too long. Your spouse who refused to go to the doctor. These are things I heard frequently. In Tibetan Buddhism, there's a set of teachings called the Lojong teachings. And they're presented in the form of short, pithy phrases. One of them is, drive all blames into one. And it's typically understood to mean that we should not look externally and blame others for the causes of our suffering, but we should consider it, our suffering, as a result of our own past harmful actions and turn our attention to purifying our lives and our behavior in this life, to purify our karma. That may or may not be a helpful way of thinking about it, but I found a somewhat different understanding of that Lojong phrase, drive all blames into one. And this, I'll give you this personal story. This was in the wake of my younger sister's death in 1990. Michael and I had been living in Japan, as many of you know. She had come to see us. She had met our friend, our Japanese friend, Takayuki. They fell in love. And in 1988, the year after we moved back here, she moved to Japan and married him. A year later, she came down with Burkitt's lymphoma. You may not have ever heard of it because it's rare. It's the most aggressive lymphoma there is. And it is the most common childhood cancer in Africa. She died at the age of 35, and that was the outside range of adults getting this type of lymphoma. It took 7 months. She died in Tokyo, didn't make it home. After intensive chemotherapy and a failed bone marrow transplant, I spent 5 of those months with her and was there with her at the end, and it changed my life. Why did she get such a rare cancer, at the most common childhood cancer in Africa, living in Tokyo? Impossible to know. Absolutely impossible to know. But feelings of helplessness, anger, and blame arose in me anyway. So 6 months later, I sat in a week-long Vipassana retreat. I think it was my first, I'd been practicing Zen at that point for about 7 years, and this was my first Vipassana retreat, and the first time that I had done metta, or loving-kindness practice, and we did the metta practice every afternoon. And when you do that metta practice, you also always begin with forgiveness practice. And so, as is traditional, I had to start with myself. Because I did blame myself, totally irrationally, but with the logic of a child's magical thinking. You know, little children think it's their fault when something bad happens. And when we're in grief, we regress, and we have that kind of logic arises. I didn't believe that I should have been able to heroically save my sister, but I did believe that I was somehow to blame. After all, I was the oldest. After all, if I hadn't gone to Japan in the first place, she wouldn't have followed. If I'd not been me, she wouldn't have died. I had not protected her. I hadn't warned her of how challenging living in Japan could be. She'd seemed so naive in her expectations. So I had to sit in meditation with that pain of that self-condemnation and soften into kindness. That's the practice. And then there were more blames. Each day I went deeper. There was her husband. How he hadn't let her cry, how he insisted she should be like some impassive samurai's wife. There was Michael and the pain in our relationship around that time, feeling that, softening. There was my family and the harms in our growing up. There was Michael's family. There's my sister's in-laws. Going back in the family histories, what did I come to? The World War II, the enmity between Japan and the United States, where I grew up, right? So not only did I have to forgive myself, I had to forgive the immediate people who had been part of that experience. I had to then look into our families, forgive our families. I had to look into our countries. I had to look at my feelings around my country of birth, which are really complicated, because my sister was afraid to go back. Why? Because she couldn't get health insurance. Why? Because she heard that someone in Florida had shot a Japanese student dead who had just come to the door asking for directions. So I had to look into the ancient twisted karma of my country, of Japan. All the layers of human fear and pain and confusion, as well as courage, forbearance and kindness. I had to look at it all. And in doing that, all blames melted into one, dissolved. There was no blame. There was no blame left. There was just what happened. And in doing that, my question changed from why to how. How then shall I live? Being able to shift that question is the gateway to healing and resilience. Of course, there are pragmatic reasons to ask and answer why questions. But I'm not talking about those. I'm talking more about the existential questions. So maybe I can paraphrase the Buddha's parable of the arrow. Some of you know this parable well, so I'm going to tell it differently. If someone shoots you on the street and you're bleeding badly and the paramedics arrive, are you going to insist on knowing why that person shot you? What kind of gun they were using, and whether it was legally owned before that you let the paramedic treat you? You bleed to death first. The Buddha as paramedic, is offering a way to remove the bullet, care for the wound, and heal. Understanding of the causes and conditions of the event may come or not, but guaranteed they will be partial, because we can never see the whole picture back through time and out in space of conditions that came together in this one event. We can never see the whole picture. The challenge is how to live and regain your strength and not be disabled by fear, resentment, and anger. How can your suffering open your mind to the human condition and your heart to the suffering of others? There's another Lojong slogan, I think is my favorite, which goes, turn all adversity into the path. No matter what happens, turn it into your path, into the practice. Given that this has happened, how do you walk the path of a bodhisattva and not create more harm and be of some benefit? So from why to how, that's a crucial key in looking into resilience. So I think I will stop there, and thank you for listening, and I will give you